Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, more than 1,000 Google employees and contractors briefly walked off the job yesterday in Europe and Asia amid complaints of racism, sexism, and abuse of executive authority in the workplace. More walkouts are scheduled today. Google's chief executive said in a statement that the company will carefully weigh its employees' demands and respond appropriately. Next, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, issued a report yesterday showing that the Afghan government controls less territory than it has at any time since the U.S. invasion. SIGAR said that the government of Ashraf Ghani controls only 55.5% of Afghanistan after 17 years of U.S. military aid and support. Then, Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-based human rights organization, released a study yesterday based on interviews with more than 100 North Korean defectors now in South Korea, saying that North Korean government officials routinely commit sexual violence against women with impunity. The allegation is shocking, but critics say this is just another smear job to derail steps toward peace in Korea. And then the Bank of England this morning warned of an economic catastrophe if the UK leaves the European Union without a Brexit deal. Bank Governor Mark Carney said that, absent an agreement, the UK should expect gridlock in its ports and airports, inflation, and a collapse in the value of the pound. This comes as police open a criminal probe into pro-Brexit campaign donor Aaron Banks, who has been the target of conspiracy theories relating to his business interests in Russia. And finally, Representative Steve King, a Republican of Iowa, is one of the most conservative and anti-immigrant members of the House of Representatives. He calls himself a nationalist. Many of his detractors call him a bigot, a racist, and a white nationalist. King made a controversial tweet a few days ago and instantly moved his safe Republican seat to a toss-up. Is there a limit to xenophobia, even for so-called conservative Republicans? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Google. More than 1,000 Google employees and contractors briefly walked off the job yesterday in Europe and Asia amid complaints of racism, sexism, and abuse of executive authority in the workplace. More walkouts are scheduled today. Google's chief executive said in a statement that the company will carefully weigh its employees' demands and will respond appropriately. We're joined from San Francisco by Patricia Gorky. She's an activist and a tech worker. Welcome back, Patricia.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I gotta say, Patricia, I was surprised for two different reasons when I saw this news. First of all, you sort of imagine Google as being such a happy place, right? One of the best managed, best run major companies in the world. Everybody has plenty of benefits. Everybody's young and happy, and they have a healthy cafeteria that they give you free food and free transportation. It's just the best place in the world to work. And then you have people actually walking off the job because it's not such a happy place. There's racism, there's sexism, there's bullying. What do you think about these reports?
You talk about Google's image, and it's correct. The image that Google portrays is of their original model, Don't Be Evil, which coincidentally they've done away with. Google has done an excellent job as portraying themselves as a progressive bastion. But what we see is actually an epidemic of sexual harassment, particularly at these large tech corporations that own billions and billions of dollars, make billions of dollars off of their tech workers, and that end up protecting sexual assaulters. The recent walkouts that have been called today globally that have happened in more than 40 cities with, I believe the number was 3,000 Google employees that walked out, women and men, and people in solidarity with them, carrying signs that say "Time's up, tech workers' rights are women's rights." And we're seeing that tech workers are rising and not willing to accept this treatment any longer.
I'm wondering, too, if there's more to this. Do you see this spreading not just elsewhere throughout Google around the world, but to other major companies where things like this may be going on and we just don't know about it?
Absolutely. This needs to spread. This movement needs to spread and needs to grow because sexual harassment is such a major problem and discrimination is such a major problem within the tech industry in particular. So in the case of Google, of what happened was there was a recent New York Times article that came out that showed that Google awarded $90 million in an exit package to Andy Rubin, And according to the New York Times, a Google employee came forward to assert that Rubin had coerced her into sex. That is rape. And Google investigated this charge, determined it was credible. And instead of firing Rubin and helping the woman press charges, Google gave Rubin a $90 million exit package. That's $2 million a month over 4 years. And his last payment will be next month. And there are many examples of this within Google. But when we look out throughout the tech industry, this is actually pretty standard. Michael Moritz, the chairman of Sequoia Capital, a billionaire and a former member of the Google board, he in 2013 made the statement that, oh, you know, we'll hire women. We just don't want to lower our standards. And then also the billionaire Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, who has ties to Facebook, one of the very early investors who donated more than $1 million to Trump, was defended by Zuckerberg. So he co-authored a book in 1996 where he insinuated that the real victims of the movement to end sexual assault are men.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
I mean, Andy Rubin was given $90 million. Larry Page, Google's chief executive, said when he was departing the company, without referring to the fact that they had found the allegations of sexual abuse, really rape, as credible, the Google executive said, quote, Page said, quote, I want to wish Andy all the best with what's next. With Android, he created something truly remarkable with a billion plus happy users. Now, this is for a guy who they found credible evidence that he had raped another Google employee. So they say, fond farewell, Andy. Amazing. You did a great job. And by the way, here's another $90 million. You know, you think of the old boys club as being like old style capitalist, you know, hardcore industry. This is Google. This is high tech. This is Silicon Valley. In spite of all of these kind of images that you talked about in the beginning, John, which is designed to give the idea that everybody's just a kind of has a happy hippie life.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same old boys club. And they're all rich.
Yeah.
And they're all protecting themselves and they're all rewarding themselves.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Go ahead, Patricia.
I can definitely attest that every woman in the tech industry has a story of harassment, has a personal story of harassment. For me, that is also the case for every woman that I know within tech, for every LGBTQ person in tech, every minority in tech. There is such a widespread bigotry within the tech industry. One example is also in 2017 of last year, then Google engineer James Damore circulated this internal memo saying that women were biologically inferior and ergo not capable of really being good software engineers. And this was really a manifesto of male chauvinism. It circulated within the company for about a month where many engineers came forward and agreed with him, maybe not publicly, but internally. To my knowledge, they haven't been fired. James Damore was fired only 2 days after the memo was leaked to the media. And this really highlights the nature of tech where women, you know, we are half the globe. We make up half the globe. We are more than half of the entire workforce in this country. And yet women make up less than 20% of U.S. tech workers. And this isn't just about, you know, this isn't the nature of the job. That has nothing to do with technology. Because in fact, women now hold a lower share of computer science jobs than they did in the 1980s.
Interesting.
Within tech, within our jobs, women are held to much more stringent standards than men. Women are paid 70 cents to the male dollar. And when we have children, we're forced to choose between employment and caring for a child. And when women return to the workforce after taking time to care for their child, they do not have the tools within the company to be able to reassimilate into their job and rejoin the workforce. And this is also, I mean, this certainly isn't just tech. The United States is the only developed country with no maternal leave, much less paternal leave.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
And what happens is that you have companies that portray themselves as progressive and maybe offer certain benefits for maternity leave, for things that really should be fundamental rights for everyone. But ultimately, when you have a system that's based on hoarding and on consolidating wealth into the hands of Peter Thiel, who owns the spy company Palantir with clients like the CIA, Department of Homeland Security, when you have Zuckerberg, Michael Moritz, all of these billionaires that control our society, these are also the corporations that are going to form as a result.
Patricia Gorky is our guest. We're talking to her from San Francisco. Patricia is an activist and a tech worker. The demands, Patricia, there's many from the workers who are walking out on strike. An end to forced arbitration in cases of harassment and discrimination for all current and future employees. A commitment to end pay and opportunity inequity. Publicly disclosed sexual harassment transparency report. These are just some of the demands. Google says, okay, we're going to listen to them. We're going to weigh them. Obviously, Google knows the deal. The Google management knows the deal. Do you think these workers, given the fact that they've had this global day of protest or days of protest, you think this will keep going? 30 seconds left.
I think it needs to keep going. One of the other demands is to appoint an employee representative to the board of directors of Google. And this highlights the fact that people are recognizing that women's rights are workers' rights. And we need to build the movement and build the struggle. And just as workers at Google shut down Project Maven, so workers in tech are going to shut down sexual discrimination and hold these companies accountable and work to build a just society.
That was the voice of Patricia Gorky. She is an activist and a tech worker, and she joined us from San Francisco, California. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, issued a report yesterday showing that the Afghan government controls less territory than it has at any time since the U.S. invasion. SIGAR said that the government of Ashraf Ghani controls only 55.5% of Afghanistan after 17 years of U.S. military aid and support. We're joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Good to have you, Kathy.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Kathy, 9 years ago when I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, we talked about how things were really not looking good for the U.S. in Afghanistan. And it was because despite the billions upon billions of dollars that we were spending in training, the Afghans were just simply not ready or maybe not willing to take over security in their country. Here we are now, 17 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and the Afghan government controls less territory than it ever has since that invasion. The Taliban controls more territory, and indeed, the territory that the government controls is not even contiguous. It's these little pockets of pro-government areas here and there, usually around cities. We could talk all month about where we went wrong. So I'll ask you, what do we do next?
Well, I think that it's a hard pill for any politician to swallow because nobody wants to be the one who says, okay, the troops are coming back, and then were there to be another terrorist attack, people could say, oh, see what you did. You took troops out of Afghanistan, and that was the place that could be a training ground. But it's such a conundrum because, I mean, as it is right now in those areas where the Taliban control territory that are more rural, that's an ideal spot for them to engage in training and in recruitment. And the country has become so desperate that it all feeds the rising militarism and the rising insurgency. So I think that the United States should be honest that war has never been an answer to a problem in Afghanistan, that it was a problem the United States helped create in the first place by being so supportive of the Mujahideen that fought against the Soviet Union. When Zbigniew Brzezinski, learning that the Soviets were going to invade Afghanistan, said, oh, good, now they'll have their Vietnam. So it's been a sordid and a terrible drain on the resources of Afghanistan, and certainly on the resources of the United States as well. The people who have benefited have been the weapon makers and various warlords. I mean, it's just stunning to me that now it's still averaging $45 billion a year to maintain this United States military presence in Afghanistan. And there you have a country that's reeling from drought, 21 provinces suffering from drought, people fleeing into refugee camps that can't sustain them, unemployment sky high, you know, young people just trying to encourage one another and grasp onto some kind of a vision of a normal future, but it's very hard for them to do. And what has the United States done to help people in this dire situation? I think the thing for the United States to do is to admit we made a terrible mistake and we're sorry. Get out of that country militarily and then start the work of encouraging reparations to be paid to people who don't have a history of corruption.
Brian, Kathy's right. I remember George W. Bush in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan saying that the purpose of this invasion was to destroy al-Qaeda. This was immediately after the 9/11 attacks. Destroy al-Qaeda. 90-something percent of Americans agreed. We need to destroy al-Qaeda before they attack us again. And then he started using the word nation building, which is an entirely different prospect. Nation building is something that very few Americans support. But there was this mission creep from the very beginning. The mission changed. And now here we are 17 years later, having spent more than $1 trillion that could have been spent on healthcare and education and infrastructure, among other things. And we're actually worse off than we were 17 years ago.
And the Afghans in particular are worse off.
Indeed.
And also the language of nation building is not only euphemistic, it's also, you know, profoundly wrong. Because, of course, Afghanistan was a nation. It was built. What's happened is it's not nation building, but nation destruction. And it's gone on for decades. Afghanistan had a revolution, a coup that brought to power in 1978, a socialist government. When you look at their actual program, it was basically a democratic program that was, you know, from a Western point of view, it was more or less like a social democratic program.
Yeah.
There should be literacy. People should have a minimum wage. Unions should be legalized. There should be land to the peasants. Girls and women should have the right to go to school throughout the country, not just in Kabul and some of the bigger cities. It was basically a very mild, moderate program. But because Afghanistan, that government was aligned with the Soviet Union, it became the target of what was, up until then, at least, the CIA's biggest covert operation ever. And since then, Afghanistan's nation has been not built, but destroyed. And of course, I agree with you, Kathy. If the U.S. left, ultimately, one way or another, we don't know how it would exactly play out. But with the circumstance of self-determination, the Afghans would rebuild and they would actually get their nation back.
Well, I've been impressed with the efforts of young people living in Kabul to, for a third year in a row now, bring together people representing every province in Afghanistan, young people who all have in common a desire to say we don't want to continue being people who are burdened by this terrible war. And one of the things that they need to do is learn one another's language and better understand one another's differences. But there's a willingness to do that. And I think that it's very difficult to foster that. It's true. It's difficult for people who are non-Afghan to travel anywhere in Afghanistan, which of course has helped to feed the corruption, because people say, sure, give us money for this project or that project, and they pocket the money, don't carry out the project, and figure, well, who's ever going to come here to find out? But, you know, just as one indication of where the United States funding goes, if you work for the State Department in Kabul, say, and you want to fly out, perhaps because something's happening in your family and it isn't something that the U.S. government will pay for, you have to yourself pay $120,000 to cover the expense for security and airfare to go by helicopter from the embassy to the airport. They can't drive because it's so unsafe. Well, these are huge expenses that get racked up, and this is how you know, it turns out that the United States is this year spending another $45 billion. And as you indicate, that's coming from taxpayers' monies that could be directed elsewhere. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a person in Afghanistan today who would say that the United States has made their country better or that the war has made gains for them, unless they happen to be people who've benefited from these tremendously corrupt practices, or in the United States, people from companies like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and General Dynamics, Boeing, and of course, generals who've gotten promotions all along, or people who wanted to experiment with various kinds of drone warfare and other kinds of armaments, the one that they call the mother of all bombs, a terrible explosive device that they set off in the mountains in the eastern part of the country. Well, you know, it's a sordid and a terrible war, and it's largely forgotten still by the United States public.
Kathy, we have about 45 seconds left. I noticed in the Washington Post today that Republicans, some of them for the very first time, are beginning to call for a unilateral withdrawal from Afghanistan. Do you see that happening?
Well, I wouldn't rule it out, but I think it's going to take more than a few calls. It's going to take a push on the part of the U.S. public as well, saying we've had it, we're war weary, we don't want this to continue.
Yep, we will leave it there. That was the voice of Kathy Kelly, who joined us from Chicago. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-based human rights organization, released a study yesterday based on interviews with more than 100 defectors from North Korea, now in South Korea, saying that the North Korean government officials routinely commit sexual violence against women with impunity. The allegation is shocking, but critics say this is just another smear job to derail steps towards peace in Korea. We're joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong. She is the Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz. She is also a member of Korea Policy Institute. Dr. Hong, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Anyway, this report and the executive director of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, he's certainly all over the mainstream media last night and today. It's obviously a big rollout of a media campaign. Let's talk about the story, the headline. I'm looking at Human Rights Watch, this 98-page report. North Korea, sexual violence against women by officials, subtitle, impunity for assault and rape by men in power. What's your take?
You know, one thing that I've noticed is that in the Trump era, the human rights industry that was geared toward war intervention and had been placed on imperialist war footing during the George W. Bush era has desperately been seeking relevance. And so they have not been a central part of the conversation between the United States and North Korea. You know, at this particular moment, had Human Rights Watch seen fit to come out and call for an end to the Korean War, and if Human Rights Watch had pointed out the structural violence, the massive human rights violations of the North Korean people and the South Korean people that come from the state of unending war, I would have been impressed. But this particular report, it basically rehashes on the level of methodology, on the level of message, a kind of interventionist, it's very interventionist on the level of rhetoric, and it's also extraordinarily condescending. Ken Roth basically stated a couple of things. He said that, you know, the sort of Western human rights industry and Human Rights Watch in particular would be more than happy to guide North Korea in having sort of proper, having sort of ironing out this particular issue of sexual violence. And the second thing that he stated was that Moon Jae-in, the current president of South Korea, was absolutely wrong-headed in terms of prioritizing peace and denuclearization over issues like the one that he has been going on the media mentioning. So I think that, you know, it's interesting. It's on the one hand, you can see that this is a kind of rearing of the ugly head of the interventionist human rights industry. And it's also a recourse, as I was saying, on the level of methodology to extraordinarily flawed ways of looking at North Korea that naturalize a war lens. If you think about the sources for this particular report, it's defectors. And defectors are a notoriously unreliable source of information. And the information that is gleaned from defectors, in the case of North Korea, this information has been instrumentally used to actually make the case for war. And a series of really securitized solutions to North Korea's human rights problems, including sanctions and things that actually harm the human rights of people, without actually thinking about the biggest structural issue that impacts the rights of Koreans north and south of the DMZ, which is the state of unending war. So basically what Ken Roth is making recourse to is human intelligence. This is what it's known as within the intelligence industry, human, defector testimony. And I just actually have to say this, even though we're in an era in which Donald Trump just, you know, makes a lot of hay by just, you know, dogging the corporate media. He does it for his own particular agenda. We have to recall that with regard to North Korea, there has never been anything like a neutral perception of North Korea within the West. You know, even as early as the late 1940s, Anna Louise Strong, an American journalist who was there witnessing the North Korean Revolution as it was happening, said that there was no way that the Western media would ever honestly report on North Korea. You know, there have been other people who have said, I mean, this is, for example, the documentary filmmaker, the French documentary filmmaker, Chris Marker, he said that the victor's gaze is obscene when it comes to North Korea. So really, like, what we're looking at right now is a kind of lens that is aimed at war. It's human intelligence, the other major lens by which North Korea is quote-unquote known within the intelligence community is through satellite imagery. And we have to recall that both forms of intelligence were used to make the specious case that Colin Powell made before the United Nations, arguing that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. As we, of course, know, that was far from the case. Again, in this particular moment, we hear the beating of the war drum.
That's the voice of Dr. Christine Hong.
Yeah, Christine makes an important point here, too, that human or human intelligence is very frequently both the best source of intelligence and the worst source of intelligence. And so you really never know what you're going to get. Well, that's why you need to vet all this information.
Yeah, and what we do know is that, and John, you and I have talked about it on the show, and I'm sure, Christine, you talk about it repeatedly. There are always reports coming from North Korea defectors that are reported from basically South Korean intelligence, many of which turn out to be not true, like Kim Jong-un's ex-girlfriend was killed and blown up with, you know, artillery fire or something like that. Then she's performing at a concert. You know, there's all of these stories that make a big splash. They make the rounds, then they get taken back. But this is a little bit different because it's a big report, and Human Rights Watch has the imprimatur of being a defender or a guarantor of human rights sort of in a seemingly neutral way. And some people, naive people or people who don't know the story, won't really understand that Human Rights Watch is a specifically political organization with political agendas. And I want to read from Ken Roth, who Dr. Hong has mentioned. He is the executive director of Human Rights Watch. Listen to this quote about this 86-page report. Quote, "Sexual violence in North Korea is an open, unaddressed, and widely tolerated secret," said Kenneth Roth, Human Rights Watch executive director. Quote, "North Korean women would probably say, 'Me too,' if they thought there was any way to obtain justice, but their voices are silenced in Kim Jong-un's dictatorship." Now, how does Ken Roth know what North Korean women think? And why does he use the characterization that they would undoubtedly be speaking up for themselves if but for the dictatorship, as he describes it, of North Korea? This is language that's designed to reinforce, one, the caricature of, or the negative image of North Korea. And secondly, it shows the purely political nature of the report and Roth's intervention, because he's not really talking so much about women and what happens to women in North Korea as much as he's talking or framing it as part of the struggle against the North Korean dictatorship at the moment that the U.S. government seems to be suggesting, as Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo have, that they're going along with the initiative from North Korea and South Korea to reduce tensions on the Korean Peninsula, to begin the process of walking back from a state of legal and technical war, and possibly bringing about the peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula. There's an obvious political agenda by Human Rights Watch and Ken Roth. Go ahead, Dr. Hong.
You know, I guess one thing that I would mention here is that you point out a really interesting feature of North Korean human rights politics. As I mentioned, this was really a war politics that congealed during the George W. Bush era, when there was another attempt by the two Koreas to actually forge together a future that was demilitarized, that enabled the reconciliation of the Korean peoples. And during this time, George W. Bush basically gave his sanction and funding, massive funding, to North Korean human rights industry that really was a renovated Cold War industry. In fact, you know, the noted human rights scholar describes American human rights, U.S. human rights, as historically in its origins, anti-communism by another name. So during the George W. Bush era, you basically saw all these different Cold War anti-communist organizations attempt to renovate themselves as quote-unquote human rights organizations. And with regard to this particular industry, one thing that you see is the structural condescension that is built into it. And what I mean by that is basically defectors don't speak by themselves, and they don't speak in unscripted ways. They are always already being spoken for through a very hostile geopolitical situation. And so, Kent, you know, like if you look at any defector memoir that has made Amazon's bestseller list, you see that every single last one of them was co-authored, oftentimes paired with a rabid anti-communist. It's interesting to note that the Washington Post journalist Blaine Hardin, he was the author, interestingly enough. He made no bones about it. He didn't even attempt to have co-authorship with the defector whose voice he was appropriating, but he wrote the story of this defector, Shim Dong-hyuk. And he basically, you know, in, again, sort of classic arrogant fashion, both pointed to the weakness of human intelligence, but then stated that it was all that existed. And he said that David Hawk, who was long a kind of rabid interventionist human rights figure within the North Korean human rights industry, he basically said that David Hawk acknowledged the weaknesses of defector testimony, but said that until North Korea opened itself up to the interventionist sort of, you know, designs of countries like the United States, that testimony singularly stands. Well, guess what? Shin Dong-hyuk came out as saying that he lied about his testimony. And he was exposed not only by his father, who came out, North Korea actually made a video of his father, but it was actually who refuted the claims that his son had made, but it was actually other defectors. Other defectors in South Korea came out and said, this man is lying. This man is lying. And, you know, so when it comes to defector, quote unquote, intelligence, we have to be really, really skeptical. We must be. We have to also recall that South Korea and Japan historically have paid defectors for intelligence. You can see, like, you know, this is something that comes up time and again. And even the number of people who are supposedly incarcerated in North Korea's labor camps, that number has I've even traced it in terms of a single defector who basically his numbers have wildly increased and varied over time. But for the longest period of time, the State Department cited him alone.
John, skepticism has to be the watchword on defector testimony, especially in the case of Korea.
It does. With any human intelligence, skepticism really is the most important thing.
We've been joined from Santa Cruz, California by Dr. Christine Hong. She's the Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz. She is a member of the Korea Policy Institute. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Bank of England this morning warned of an economic catastrophe if the UK leaves the European Union without a Brexit deal. Bank Governor Mark Carney said that absent an agreement, the UK should expect gridlock in its ports and airports, inflation, and a collapse in the value of the pound. This comes as police open a criminal probe into pro-Brexit campaign donor Aaron Banks, who has been the target of conspiracy theories relating to his business interests in Russia. We're joined from London by Steve Headley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you for the invite.
Steve, it seems like we're approaching crunch time. These negotiations have been going on for many, many months, over a year, and it seems like they're no closer than they were at the beginning. Is this Bank Governor Mark Carney being a little bit over the top, or is this a real threat? Is this a real fear?
Well, there will undoubtedly be a lot of economic damage done if there's a no-deal Brexit. But what is surprising is the tone of Carney's remarks. I've never really heard a Bank of England manager speak in such terms before. And coincidentally, there seems to be an attempt to bounce the British proposal for Brexit through a very divided cabinet. So that has led the allegations of some sort of a coordinated attempt between Carney and the Prime Minister to at least get a Brexit deal that's agreeable to her own party on the table.
So again, Steve, if you might, for our American audience especially, for whom this is, you know, far away and we want to be able to have everyone understand it. So Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, is trying to go through and consummate a deal with the European Union, the terms of which would allow Britain to leave the EU with certain measures that will be, you know, to mitigate the economic impact, the damaging negative economic impact to Britain or to British corporations or British banks. At the same time, her cabinet has members who are trying to unseat her. She's the Conservative Tory Party. And so that cabinet has been saying, well, any deal like the deal she's perhaps negotiating is inadequate, and they would prefer, in fact, a no deal, for instance, a no deal to leave Brexit, meaning the terms of trade and economic intercourse may be, at least at this point, unknown. In other words, what we're witnessing and what Carney may be indicating, the central banker, is a favor to Theresa May to sabotage or defeat her political rivals within the Conservative Party. That's what you're suggesting. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. You know, when a Bank of England governor speaks, when Carney usually speaks, they obviously speak with a lot of caveats, a lot of ifs and buts and maybes, but I've never heard a speech like this one that he's made. It's basically, I think, part of Project Fear. It's trying to bounce the cabinet in to agreeing what with May's proposals, or face devastation. And that's the card that she's playing, I believe. And Carney's party to it.
Yeah, Steve Headley, let's just turn for a moment to the issue of Aaron Banks. He's a former major bankroller for the right-wing UKIP party, and the National Crime Agency has now launched an investigation into Aaron Banks and other people and groups linked to the Leave campaign, those who are advocating for Britain to leave. That was the right-wing campaign, not the left-wing Lexit campaign, but the Leave campaign. anyway, sort of the impression one gets from the, at least the media accounts, is maybe Russia is responsible after all for Brexit. Is that where this is going? Is it part of the kind of overall Russiagate? And talk about what this case means and who Arron Banks is.
Well, I mean, Arron Banks is a financier of UKIP. I don't think they're any friends of Russia. They're an extreme right-wing British party, xenophobic party, bordering really on being fascists. They're not far away from it. I don't see what connection they've got to Russia. I think that they've got, if Banks has got interests, business interests in Russia, I'd imagine they would have them elsewhere as well. I'm not an expert on where Arron Banks has got his finances, but if we look at the nature now of international global capital, it is spread worldwide. What we do know is that we have clear indications that the Israelis were trying to doctor the vote in the British election. We have them on tape that they were talking about how they were going to try to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, who they saw as a threat. You know, this was the Israeli ambassador. So I don't know why the focus. Well, I do know why the focus is on Russia. It's on Russia to discredit the opponent of the Conservative government. I don't know if Russia was involved or not. I don't see. I know for certain that the U.S. have been involved in elections all over the world, including installing military dictatorships when it suits them. So I'd be very surprised if Russia didn't have an interest in elections around the world, but it's no different than any other country in that respect.
Well, speaking of that, Steve Hedley, we're speaking from London with Steve Hedley. Steve is the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Speaking of that issue, of the issue of meddling, if I remember right before the June 2016 Brexit referendum, Barack Obama was in the UK and he said if the British people voted to leave the European Union, the UK would go to the back of the queue, meaning to the back of the line for US-British trade. It seemed, at least from over here, that Barack Obama had a preference, and the preference was for Britain to remain in the EU. And he used the suggestion that America's economic clout would be used against Britain if it voted to leave. In other words, wouldn't that be perceived as interference, or was it perceived as interference?
Well, I think it was perceived as interference by people who were pro-Brexit, but the mainstream media, I mean, I think Barack Obama was Teflon, wasn't he? I mean, he was carrying out bombings of countries all over the world and not a word of criticism from the liberal press. I mean, obviously, I think he was better than Trump, but not much better. I mean, Obama was the perfect foil, in a way, for American imperialism. He was a nice face, a nice mask for them to wear, whereas Trump has exposed it in all its horrid reality. But yeah, I mean, Barack Obama did interfere in elections, but it wasn't in the interest of the mainstream media to call him out over that issue.
Steve, I have a political question for you. As this Brexit negotiation drags on and there doesn't appear to be any tangible progress right now, what does this do to extremist parties, especially extremist parties on the right? Does it make them more appealing to voters who are frustrated by this process, or less?
Well, I'm not really sure. I think that UKIP has collapsed. UKIP is virtually gone. They're now running around with street fascists like Tommy Robinson and the DFLA, which is Democratic, so-called Democratic Football Lads Alliance, which are basically right-wing street thugs. So as an electoral threat at the minute, the UKIP party has diminished rapidly. But what we do have is the right wing of the Conservative Party, who would really be an extreme right wing party in terms of certainly the European scene. There's a chance that they might break away and form their own party. So whether voters would actually go for that, out of absolute frustration with the lack of progress on Brexit, I don't really know. I haven't seen any surveys for or against that. So I think it's just guesswork at the minute.
Well, speaking of guesswork, Steve, in our last 90 seconds, I know you don't have a crystal ball, and we got rid of ours, so, you know, we're at a disadvantage about predicting the future. But what do you think is likely in terms of Brexit? Will there be a deal? Will this actually happen? And if it doesn't happen, what does a no-deal Brexit mean?
Okay, well, first of all, every deal that's done in the European Union is done at the last minute. That's how they work. So there's a real chance that Brexit, there will be a deal done on Brexit or some sort of fudge. But I think that there is a real chance, probably 60-40, I would thought, that there will be a deal. I think there's a 40% chance of the right wing of the Conservative Party pulling the plug and not allowing a deal of any sort. And I think, to be honest, that's going to be very, very bad for the British economy and the economies of Europe as well, which, you know, they need each other for trade. And especially the issue of the Irish border, which we haven't even raised yet. We could have a situation where even conflict might be reignited in the north of Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't talk about Ireland, but I think we're out of time. Maybe on the next call, we'll talk about what this impact means for the people of Ireland.
You know, and to me, this issue of Ireland is one of the most important parts of the Brexit negotiations. We're out of time. We were joined from London by Steve Headley. Steve's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Representative Stephen King, a Republican of Iowa, is one of the most conservative, right-wing, and anti-immigrant members of the House of Representatives. He calls himself a nationalist. Many of his detractors call him a bigot, a racist, and a white nationalist. King made a controversial tweet a few days ago and instantly moved his safe Republican seat to a toss-up status. Is there a limit to xenophobia, white supremacy, even for this, quote, conservative, close quote, Republican? John Kiriakou, we're doing this daily segment in the run-up to the midterms. We want to focus on different aspects of the midterms. I want to interview you. Do you agree?
Sure.
You'll be a guest?
I look forward to this.
Okay. What's up with Steve King? I mean, and what's up with the Republican Party? I mean, I know it's an extreme right-wing party, but this guy is off the charts.
Off the charts is really a nice way to put it. I've often been amused by Steve King just because he's so much of a right-wing extremist as to be a nut that he was entertaining. With Donald Trump in the White House, though, this isn't entertainment anymore. This is dangerous. He makes no apologies for his racist views, his xenophobic policy positions. He genuinely hates immigrants. He subscribes to a conspiracy theory called the white genocide theory. I'm going to read you, Brian, just a couple of sentences about this white genocide theory. It says, the white genocide conspiracy theory is a neo-Nazi, alt-right, white nationalist, white supremacist conspiracy theory, which contends that any one of mass immigration, racial integration, miscegenation, low fertility rates, abortion, government land confiscation, organized violence, or eliminationism are being promoted to in either predominantly white countries or white-founded countries to deliberately replace, remove, or liquidate white populations, dismantle white collective power, turn the country's minority white, and cause white people to become extinct through forced assimilation or violent genocide.
You know, when the people, the so-called Unite the Right rally happened in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12th, 2017, those racists, many of whom were using the Nazi salute, Nazis, Klan, et cetera, whatever iteration, whatever name they take, their chants were, Jews will not replace us. Now, clearly, they don't think that Jewish people in the United States, for instance, are white people because of their, you know, they have Aryan racial supremacy theories.
Right.
The person who carried out the massacre in Pittsburgh, he was like, Jews. Mm-hmm. Everything was against Jews, this sort of anti-Semitic rage. The white genocide theory is a threat to and targets black people, Latino people, all people who are people of color, and Muslims, to mention a few. In other words, it's the targeting of people attempting to stop the so-called white genocide, of course, which is a complete racist fantasy.
A total racist fabrication.
Yeah, it's just a fantasy. But it's not just an ideology. It's an ideology that ultimately, once embraced, leads to violence against people who these racists say are replacing white people. That's what we saw in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, you can say, well, that was, there's people who are mentally ill. Yes, of course, there's
sure.
mentally ill
Always.
People. There's mentally ill people throughout society. Mental illness is a thing. You could be left, you could be right, whatever. But this language, this rhetoric, these ideas are in fact designed to create hatred and then violence against the so-called perpetrators of white genocide. Steve King is really within this ideological framework.
And this is what is exactly so dangerous, because Steve King is actually an important member of Congress. He has a soapbox. He commands the attention of the media and thousands upon thousands of Twitter followers. So he can spew this hate and actually find an audience for it. Finally, after all these years, Steve King has been in Congress since 2003. But finally, just in the last 48 hours, the Republican National Campaign Committee announced that it would no longer support him. They've withdrawn all aid. Other people are announcing their opposition to him, including other Republican members of the House of Representatives. And the Cook Political Report has moved this race from safe Republican to lean Republican. So finally, people are beginning to object. Even the likes of Ted Cruz objected to King's tweet the other day. But let's talk about other things that he's said, because this isn't something new.
Yeah, let's go through some of them.
He's compared immigrants to dogs. He did this relatively recently. He said that migrants have calves the size of cantaloupes because they're used to transporting heavy loads of marijuana on their backs over long distances. He tweeted a cartoon that showed Barack Obama wearing a turban and identified him as a Muslim. He retweeted a message from a self-described Nazi sympathizer and was not punished in any way by the Republican caucus. He voiced support in a tweet just a month ago for an unsuccessful mayoral candidate in Toronto who has promoted this nonsensical white genocide theory. And then in Europe, he's actually become something of a darling of the far right, where he has traveled to Europe to campaign side by side with the likes of Marine Le Pen in France, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. I mean, these are self-described neo-Nazis, self-described white nationalists. And until 48 hours ago, there was no price for this guy to pay. It looks like now, finally, people may have had enough. Now, this is a district, Brian, that has never been won by a Democrat. So it's too early to say he's blown it. He's finally stepped over the line. We don't know.
Yeah. And again, he's been there since 2003. So all of the people working with him know this about him.
Oh, sure. This isn't a revelation to anybody in the House of Representatives.
But, you know, Donald Trump's ambassador to Germany, the person the Trump administration chose, Richard Grenell, he says that part of his agenda as ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Germany, a function of the State Department, is actually to go around to promote the agenda and the possible victory of these same far-right parties. In other words, it's an ideological agenda. So while Steve King is Steve King, his agenda is dovetailing with another big group of people who support Donald Trump and who Donald Trump supports.
Yes.
Like Grinnell.
And there are others. This guy Stivers in Ohio, another congressman, chairman of the House Republican Campaign Committee. He assailed Stephen King for what he called white supremacy and hate. But until 48 hours ago, he was happy to write this guy checks and help him get reelected every other year since 2003.
Yep. And Steve King, he said, was it King who said we can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies?
Yeah.
That's Steve King.
Yeah, he tweeted that last year. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. I don't even have words to describe how offensive these kinds of tweets are. But this is a guy who does this kind of thing all the time. He even keeps a Confederate flag in his office on his desk.
Because Iowa was part of the Confederacy?
Right. Iowa being from the Deep South, was a part of the Confederacy, apparently.
Well, you told me that he had the Confederate flag up before the show. So I did a little research. How many Iowans were in the Civil War on the side of the Northern Army? 76,242 men from Iowa were in the Civil War, U.S. Civil War, on the side of the now North, out of a population of 674,000. So 76,000 people, men in Iowa, served in the North, for the North, against the Confederacy.
It's like 12% of the population.
Yeah. The number of casualties from Iowa, 14,000 on the Northern side. 11,000 wounded, 3,000 died. 28 Iowans received the Medal of Honor for gallantry, for bravery in the fight against the Confederacy, against the slaveocracy. And Steve King, who says he represents the people of Iowa, has the Confederate flag in his office.
The Confederate flag. Brian, I'm from Western Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvanians were proud Unionists during the Civil War. It wasn't until I moved to the Washington area to go to college when I was 18 years old that I realized that not everybody was taught that Robert E. Lee was a traitor. And so when I came here and I saw a Confederate flag literally for the first time in my life, I was stunned that people still have this kind of ideology.
And Robert E. Lee, by the way, I think shares the same birthday as Martin Luther King Jr.
Isn't that poetic?
January 15th. And at least through the 1980s, John, while you were probably in Virginia, a Virginian celebrated not Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, but Robert E. Lee's birthday. So Steve King is an extremist, a racist. But when you think about it, part and parcel of this longer strand and stream of white supremacy in America. Anyway, John, we're completely out of time.
We are out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.